There were a dozen virgins, Frisians, Tains, and Franks. We took them for some picking, but all we got were wanks. Oh, we are Beowulf's army, each a mighty Tain. We'll pummel your asses and ravage your lasses and do it all again. The prettiest of the virgins, she was so fair and sweet. I told her I'd an organ for where to spread my seed. The oldest of the virgins, she was a vandal lass. I showed her my mighty weapon, and she showed me her ass. The fattest of the virgins, we took her for a whore. I gave her all me codpiece, she still wanted more. Her sister was from Norway, she cost me 20 groats. She showed me there was more ways than one to show me oats. Her mother was from Iceland, and she was very hot. It took a whole damn iceberg to cool her burning twat.
Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses. Or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes, composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you. Hello, everyone. I'm Renzo del Castillo, and with me always is...
Scott, 3T's Raven, coming at ya.
Coming at ya. And we are real poets. And today, we are diving into...
I cried so hard once, I pulled a rib from my teeth. It must have been the one torn from Cain. Excavated from the same cave Grendel was slain. I too have lain next to the body of my own dragon son, always uncertain of what I or he was destined to become. War weary and mead wrecked, a forever dance with siren devils on ship decks, I cannot begin to explain. How many cursed fathers are to blame for endless terror reigned in the name of honor and fame? The not so epic heroes, fallen from grace, because their hubris was anything but humorous, nothing funny about being 12 years a slave, forced to endure our troubles today, burying our birthrights in early graves. This is the reason we must be mindful of who we ask to be saved. Beowulf.
That was dope. Thank you for that.
My pleasure.
I think for this episode, we shouldn't say the name of the film until the end in the spirit of Crystal.
I love that, actually.
Yeah. Thank you for being here for our episode for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze. Today, we are diving into Beowulf.
It is
the OG. It's one of the first epic poems, and there was a movie made in 2007 with a lot of CGI. We'll get into that. But it was recommended by our guest today, Crystal Espinoza, who is a poet, an educator. She lives inside language in a very real way. She spent 15 years teaching high school English and now serves as an assistant principal. She's also the author of Paragraphs and Pirouettes, a book that moves between structure and freedom, where attention becomes rhythm. She also is the founder of Pop-Up Poetry Miami. You may remember our former guest, Kenny Rhymes. That's her co-founder, and it's a project that brings poetry into public space and back into the mouth where it began. And I think that makes her a perfect voice for a story like Beowulf, because it's a poem that's born in performance, it's shaped by witness, and obsessed with what survives after the song is sung. So please join me in welcoming Crystal Espinoza.
Hello. Hello, Renzo. Hello, Scott Triple T. So happy to be here.
Crystal, why did you choose Beowulf?
Why not? Is my response. As a former English educator, I stumbled across Beowulf in a college classroom and was taught that Beowulf is the first epic poem ever to be found, dating somewhere between 5th century and 7th century AD. It's one of the first epic poems that references a dragon. More importantly, it survived a fire. It's said to be written and rooted in real history. Who doesn't love the story of an epic hero who battles sea monsters and said to be sirens and casts out one of the greatest stories I think that I've heard as a student and taught as an educator? Beowulf has given me life in poetry. It taught me that poems don't necessarily have to exist in rhyme. But it also taught me the very reality that everybody can be their own epic hero. And sometimes epic heroes are not so epic.
Could you tell us a little bit about your poet origin story? Because Beowulf is something I think most of us have learned in high school, maybe middle school. You decided to be an educator. You decided to teach English, to dive into poetry. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you began.
I think I've always been a silent poet. I don't think I know. I have always been a silent poet. My words were very much written in a notebook that I carried under my arm and I kept very close. My poetry existed as a younger person in the form of dance. I danced through my words and then I became a dance coach. And so I coached dance and let my stories be told by other people, most of the time students. And then I was very fortunate enough to meet a poet in New York. Her name is Sophia Kohler Derrick. She is also an educator and also a dear friend. And she gave me voice in taking what I already had that was hidden under my arm, allowing me to put it in word. She watched me as a dance coach show what I had in terms of artistry on the stage. It started in that slam poetry and in that spoken word very much alongside of community, within community, in an area where mindfulness and practice was at the forefront of my mind. But I will say, I don't think it started. I think it was birthed with me. It started very much at the time that I came to be and came to speak and came to move. But I think people come into your life for blessings and lessons and uncover truths that you're not really aware of. And then obviously my educators. As a high school student, I struggled not in academics, but in communicating. I was very much a Cuban Italian from Queens who had a lot of passion and didn't communicate very effectively, for lack of a better word. I think that a lot of my passion was mistaken for aggression, and a lot of what I lived in was mistaken for what have you. Words gave me a sense of self that I did not have the emotional awareness to connect to as a younger person. So now in my late 30s, I realize that words are not only powerful, they're impactful, but also a form of therapy for me and a form of release and connection within all realms of my life. So I can't attribute my poetic journey to one person or to one thing. I commit it to community, which is why I've decided to create pop-up poetry. It's not about me. Whose poem is it anyway, is what I like to say.
We can talk a little about pop-up poetry because sure. Beowulf, not the poem. I want to talk about the poem and the movie. The movie, at least in my opinion, talks about heroism as a performance.
Absolutely.
You just spoke about being a dancer. Mm-hmm. Using your body to tell a story through movement. And then poetry has movement within meter, movement within cadence. How has movement played a part in your expression as an artist?
That is a wonderful question. And I think that lies heavily in the title of my self-published poetry book, Paragraphs and Pirouettes. I realized that I was birthing my stories into students and having them dance my stories on stage. And I would watch it and I would get to watch my poetry come to life without words. And then I realized that for a very long time as educators, we live through the eyes of our students and we give them everything that, at least I can speak to myself, I've given my students everything that I've ever wanted. And I've watched their dreams come to fruition, some of which were mine. In looking at words and seeing my poems come to life on stage, very much in movement, through rhythm, I realize that everything that I say is in dance. And it's in rhythm with my soul. It's in rhythm with how I connect to the universe, how I connect to a higher power. So dance and poetry very much to me are in sync with one another. When I say poetry in my mind, I'm dancing. I count rhythm. I count meter. I count rhyme the same way I would when I would choreograph dance. They're simultaneous, but they're also the only way I have ever known to connect within self and within life. It's very much how I see the world. I see the world through dance and through literature. And poetry is very much a dance between the lines of living. It kind of just transitioned. I moved from giving and birthing my poetry within students in dance. And then I realized it's time to give back to me. At times I felt it was selfish. I was like, oh no, this isn't right. Like, I'm supposed to be an educator and supposed to be giving my art to kids. And then I realized it's just as authentic to give it to the person who births it, which is myself. And then I realized through struggle that maybe I was hiding behind letting someone else tell my story. I transitioned to poetry because no one else can take your words.
The listeners at home can't see, but as you were accounting that, your cat was dancing behind you. And I could see the tail moving to the rhythm of your words, which was wonderful. What's that cat's name?
Her name is Katniss, actually. Her name is Katniss from Katniss from Hunger Games. Yeah. Yes. I rescued her from a place in Queens. And when I found her, she was very much beat up and looked like she had just survived the Hunger Games. And I wanted to, this is the irony of this. I wanted to, when I pulled her off the shelf, I was like, Beowulf. I put her on the counter and I said, Beowulf. And they were like, she's a girl. She's a girl. Yeah, and I was like, but that's okay. And then I was like, but then I really looked at her and she just looked like she had been through something. I had just finished teaching a unit on Hunger Games and I thought, okay, so maybe Katniss is a little more fitting. But she would have had she been a boy. But for that particular moment, it just seemed more fitting given her state. So it's funny that you bring her up. And I tried to give her some treats so she wouldn't interrupt. But here she is stealing the show as per usual.
I don't know if we talked about this. You know that I was in good old Forest Hills, Queens, right before moving into Miami.
Get out of here. So I'm from College Point, not far from Forest Hills at all.
Did a lot of work out there with a lot of students, too. So was your teaching in Queens as well?
I was born and raised in Queens. I spent the tail end of my high school career in Staten Island. I, like you, was in multiple boroughs. The only borough I was not in, well, two boroughs. I never lived in Manhattan and I never lived in the Bronx. But I went to school in Long Island in Patchogue at St. Joseph University, where I went to school to study teaching. But I spent my last year in college during the year of the budget cuts in 2011, where most of my educators were telling me that I would never find a teaching job in New York and essentially that I would have to move out of state. So I did just that. I moved to Hawaii. I lived in Kauai and I was in Kauai ready to set roots. And it was New Year's Eve. And I looked around and I realized that I had people, but they didn't feel like family in my community. And so I knew that that wasn't my space. And in that very next day, 2 days later, I had a voicemail from Deer Park High School, where I did my student teaching, from my former student teacher, who called me to take over her space because she was leaving for maternity leave. And upon doing so, I came back and some other things happened family-wise. And I ended up and started my teaching here, actually, in Miami at a small charter school in Miami Beach called Matter Beach Academy. And then I taught at SLAM Miami in Little Havana. I moved back to Brooklyn, to East New York, and taught at Vista Academy Brooklyn for 5 years. And then found myself back in Miami for family. Thankfully, I'm so happy. I'm very grateful to be back. And now I'm at a small charter school in Little Havana called Green Springs High School, where I am the assistant principal. So for 15 years, I taught English, and now I have my first foot in the door in administration. I love it because I have a great team, and it's new, it's exciting, but it's still rooted in what I love, which is giving voices to those that might otherwise be unheard. And that's important to me as a human being. In stepping into administration, it's been hard because that has what the educating students to have a voice has been my whole entire life. And so you step outside of the classroom and you step inside administration and it becomes a little more political. And now you're educating educators. And as much as I love education, I just think that there's a rawness and a realness and a truth in words that from kids who are in it that have no filter that I miss, which is why I started Pop Up. It's to have that healthy balance between what I am as a creative, how I can teach myself to educate now in an adult frame and tie that into my administrative duties and not lose sight of my purpose. I'm a firm believer in never chase the paper, chase the purpose. And that has been my motto since day one. So yeah, education is my everything.
I feel like you just described Beowulf's dilemma in the movie. Because you went from being part of the story, being the educator, being the one that helps write the legend, to administration, to leadership, standing behind, standing back as others now do that, laying the strategy. And I see that paralleled in the story of Beowulf. The reason I bring it up is you talked about performance again. The original Beowulf is written in Old English alliterative long line verse. It's accentual meter. It's not syllabic. There's two stresses per half line. I know I'm getting a little technical here, guys, but yeah, there's a reason for it. The caesura at the center of each line. It's governed by alliteration. Again, it's no rhyme, but it's designed for oral performance.
Right.
And you've talked about needing, being driven to begin pop-up poetry, which is centered around oral performance.
Right.
How'd you get there?
I think very much, I love the synthesis there. I love the connection that you just drew. Oral storytelling is the oldest form of storytelling. There is no books, right? And so when you sit down with people and you tell a story, if you are a certified raconteur, you can really tell a story and really move people. And as an educator, that's what I do all day long. I have to get at risk, or what they call at risk, because I don't think they're at risk at all. I think they're beautiful, and I think that they're capable, and I think that so many other things. But in just getting students to engage, I have to perform all day, every day, in a form of oral storytelling. Beowulf very much spoke to me as a student prior to being an educator, because it was this epic battle within self, right? It was, most of the time you hear about the epic hero, there's always a fall. There is always a great fall in every epic hero's tale. And most of the time, if you're familiar with literary elements and how epic poetry ends, the epic hero dies. And so I think what you're asking me is very much what I'm living in, which is my story may have died on paper in the classroom as an epic teacher, right? As an epic educator and moving the young minds to be educated by for tomorrow. But I think in that death, there's always a renaissance and a rebirth. And that is very much where I am right now. So Beowulf and my connection to being the epic hero in my classroom and now being an epic hero in my office for educators and stemming into a different realm, a different battle, a different character that I have to slay is very much the story that I'm living. But I don't think that there's a direct connection between epic poetry, the Beowulf story, and my story right now. And I don't particularly connect with Beowulf at all, if I'm being honest with you, Renzo. I have no direct connection to Beowulf. In fact, I don't quite like him. I love the story. I love what he stood for when he thought he stood for something. I love that he had the gusto and the drive to want to protect and slay and become king. But I think all of his reasons for wanting to do it were so wrong. At the end of the story, he dies because of his hubris.
This is the movie version of Beowulf, correct?
So no, this is the poem.
You're going
this
for the poem?
The poem. Okay. I'm this curious. Is the poem. But also in the movie too, because there is a direct connection. I just think that a lot of what the history in the poem is left out of the movie. He does die at the end. And if you're familiar with the story, right, Beowulf was asked by King Hrothgar to come and save Heorot from a monster named Grendel. And that monster named Grendel was said to have been born from Cain. When Cain was exiled, he was sent out and he was to live the rest of his life alone. And so the story said is that Cain's rib is what birthed Grendel, this 12-foot monster that for 12 years came down to this town called Heorot and would slay the townspeople and kill the townspeople when they were in merriment. They were drinking and having a good time in the mead hall. Hrothgar couldn't kill this monster. He sought help. And in seeking help, he found Beowulf. And Beowulf was this Viking with a bit of ego, a lot of ego. It was like, I'm going to go and I'm going to kill this monster and I'm going to win the crown and take the queen. And I don't care what it takes. He even says it so confidently as to, I'm going to do it naked. Like, that's how confident I am as a human being. I'm going to kill this 12-foot monster with no armor, with no weapons. I'm just going to take him down. Beowulf travels across the sea in the movie and in the epic poem, and he battles a sea monster by the name of Breca, and he wins. And then he lands at Heorot in the mead hall and is drinking and having a great time. And Grendel, as always, shows up to kill and slay the townspeople. And Beowulf has a battle with him and takes his arm off by slamming it in a door. And when the arm falls on the floor, the people cheer and everybody's, oh, thank God for Beowulf. Beowulf says, well, I'm going to go and make sure that he's dead, to this cave, essentially where Cain was exiled to. And when he finds Grendel in this cave withering away, he stumbles upon Angelina Jolie in the movie, who is a siren, this beautiful seductress, this femme fatale who seduces him. Instead of going to the town and telling everybody, hey, I killed Grendel, but there's another monster we have to worry about, he very much decides to do the opposite and takes the crown, takes the queen, lives supposedly happily ever after, only for years later, a dragon to be spawned and come to wreak havoc upon the town. And the very end and final scene of the movie is Beowulf fighting his son. The dragon is the son that was birthed from the seductress of Siren. Yeah. And so there's this great downfall for what should be an epic hero in an epic battle. And for me, as a student, I remember listening and being like, well, what the heck? You know, like, there's this guy and I thought he was this almighty, like, yeah. But that's what makes a good story, right? Heroes maybe aren't always the heroes that we're looking for. They can only give what they have.
The way that I remember the poem, you don't really see Beowulf sleep with. He's not seduced in the poem. Like in the poem, heroism is public. It's validated by speech, by gift giving. The film deconstructs it as heroism is compromised by secrecy. Glory is negotiated. And I think the film has a lot of issues with the power of femininity versus heroism is masculinity, right?
So I do. I agree with you 100%. But there are multiple translations of that poem, Beowulf. And I think there's a Seamus Heaney translation. That Seamus Heaney translation is wonderful because when you open the pages, I actually have it right next to me. When you open the pages, it's on the left side. It's written in Old English in its original form. I've gone to London to see the original copy. It's actually the background of my phone. It's the icon on this meeting. And so that Seamus Heaney translation dives a little bit further into that secrecy that you're talking about. They don't say it, but it's implied. And then if you do some research that Grendel, maybe there's some, maybe not born of Cain, and Grendel's mother did seduce him, and that was his son, the curse of the fathers. And so that's why I love it, right? Open for interpretation, like most poems are, which makes it controversial and so exciting to teach.
Have you given a prompt when you've taught it in class?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I'd be many. So many prompts. I think my favorite prompt and the question that I have asked most students, I'm not most, because you have to be careful, right? And as an English teacher in a classroom and know your kids and know your students, know your audience. But the question is would you die to save yourself or would you die to save your child? That breeds for a different kind of conversation because it's not set in stone that the dragon was his child. Or would you die with your child? So growing up, my dad had a saying, he's Cuban, just a precursor to maybe if this rubs other people the wrong way, but I love him. And it's a lesson that has always stuck with me, which is if our house ever burnt down, if our house were ever to catch fire, either we all get out or no one gets out. And for me, that stuck with me in teaching this prompt, which is, would you save yourself? Would you sacrifice yourself? Or would you sacrifice each other for the sake of just knowing that this is kinship, that this is your loin, that this is your own child? And I think that those conversations spark interests in moral and ethical value and who you are as an individual, and then just the idea of what it means to protect and what it means to serve. And you'd be surprised how many students lean into the very opposite of where I leaned, but I'm very careful not to impose my thought process. It's just I ask the question and I kind of back up. It's like a paper mache bomb, if you will, just kind of like out there and see where it lands. But you'd be surprised how many students are very aware, very loving, and kind of inside with, no, I would protect my child at all costs. And this is at all costs. And these are kids without kids, right? Which is the beauty of teaching, because they still are unscathed for the most part.
Some idealistic.
Idealistic and rooted in love and rooted. And then there are the few that are like, absolutely not. You know, how do you know it's mine? And what if it's a dragon? And what if it's this? And what if it's that? And so that's very much where I live as an educator, just to breed conversation. And there's no real answer in literature, which is why I didn't study math. You know, it's there is no formula. There is no definitive answer. That's why I chose the book. It's very controversial. There's a million different translations and a million different renditions and so many different perspectives.
Let's get into it. Let's get into it a little bit. And I want to hear what you think, Scott, because I think we may all have different interpretations of the source text. Seamus Heaney did dive a little bit deeper. But for me, it was fascinating that the film did not aim for fidelity. It really was having a conversation, to your point, with the source text. For example, the religious framing of Cain recedes. In the movie, there is no question that the father of Rendel is Hrothgar. I think that's where moral psychology takes center stage, because we start deconstructing what it means to be a male hero. Because you have the adaptation. This adaptation asks whether heroic narratives are necessary lies or avoidable failures. Do I need to lie to do this? Did I have to fail? So, for example, in the poem, the dragon, I believe the translations that I've read for the most part, just the herald came and stole some treasure, and then Beowulf, as an older king, has to deal with the dragon, and he kind of, it's like, oh, I have to go do this, and there's self-sacrifice, but I get to be me again. I get to be the legend again, and I'm going to go forth and do it. It's fate embodied in the poem. In the film, the dragon, being Beowulf's son, is consequence returned. Mm-hmm. It was very much avoidable. He didn't have to sleep with Angelina Jolie, but when you have Grendel's mother as this monstrous avenger that he slays in the poem, depending on the translation. But in the film, she negotiates. She offers a legacy, but you have to give up the truth. She has a way to create agency and power for a woman in this world. Maybe the poem is a mirror for modern anxieties about power, masculinity, and truth. What is truth? What is masculinity? What is power? I don't know. Scott, what do you think?
It's a comment on what we were talking about earlier, a little bit on the oral tradition itself, on how stories over time can change slightly, which is why these two versions, the poem and the movie, are so different. I mean, I'm trying to wrap my head around what aspects are still poetry within the film. In place of there being poetry here, now there's these visual effects, there's CGI. The closest we get to poetry in the film is the kind of two songs, I guess.
I was about to say the drinking songs, man.
Yeah, the drinking songs. There's the one that the queen sings, and then the men right before they're ravaged by the format. We started talking a lot about dance-influenced Crystal, and I'm interested in how did this CGI add to the telling of this story. It's almost like a mixing of old technology with what at the time was new technology.
For me, no. The CGI does not enhance the poem in its authentic fashion. However, when you sit in movies, isn't that the point, right? Like that escape, that understanding of a topic being brought to play that could never have been translated in a English classroom. And that dance between power struggle, that dance between being seduced, that dance between maybe, is it my dad? Is it not my dad? Is it, you know, are those things? So for me, no, the CGI doesn't enhance the poem, because I think the poem is a standalone epic. I had a tough time choosing the movie, not because it's not good. It's good if you have history and you've read the poem. I think in reading the poem, the movie makes sense for controversy. It makes sense for conversation. It makes sense for, and so very much so as an English educator, you never show the movie first. Like, let's read this, and then you decide. And oftentimes you would think the classroom would live in the CGI and they don't. They'll be like, no, but the epic poem has this and has this and has this. Mm-hmm. The details live in the word, which is why I chose. It's not about, and I know this is real poets, and forgive me, but in this real poetry, I will sit in the realest, which is the word. And so I think that, yes, it's fun and it's playful and it's exciting and it's very much a teachable moment. It's very much a connector. But you'd be surprised how many young minds sit in the poetry if it's taught right and if it's spoken in rhythm and in a dance. Hold on, pause that. Wait, but that's not what happened here because this, and this happened here. But why'd they leave all that detail out? And that's the teachable moment for sensory details, for figurative language, for really descriptive writing, for the importance of nuance, the importance of connecting the dots between what gets really unseen, you know, really unseen in movies. So no, to answer you in my excitement, the answer is no, the CGI didn't do it for me. And it doesn't do it for most of my classrooms either.
My first encounter with the film, I saw it in 3D as well. And they went really over the top with all the phalluses and all. Yeah. Every sword was coming at you into the audience.
Right. It's funny, Scott, we were talking prior. I had a really tough time picking this movie because I myself love movies. I thought about Old Boy. I thought about Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. I thought about these great epic films because I myself am a movie buff. But then I sat and I was like, but this is a poetry podcast. Where else do I get to talk about how this movie might land with so many people in that AI world, that CGI world? How many of us really live in the root of what we're talking about, which is word, right? And like, without that poem, this movie would have never came to fruition. Just like every movie that you will ever watch, it's always written first.
Something I enjoyed about the technology is it would have been very difficult to recreate some of the epic scenes at that time using any other format.
Right.
And I mentioned to you before this episode, when we were chatting, that the Uncanny Valley eyes were kind of weird, but it was interesting that they made the actors look like their characters, except for Ray Winstone, who plays Beowulf, because, and I researched this, Zemeckis wanted him to look like even whiter Jesus. Huh. So there's that aspect to him. It's funny for me because they rescinded on that, the religious connotations that the poem has, but they made the protagonist look like Jesus. So you can find that in the documentary.
So interesting.
Yeah.
So interesting. I've not thought about that. And quite frankly, just in showing the movie and watching the movie, a lot of the religious undertakings and a lot of the religious nuances and themes were removed. But I think in the opening of Beowulf in poetic form, in the epic, the word, W-Y-R-D, is referenced over like 250 times, which in Old English is the term for God. So I myself was wondering why that religious aspect was removed from the movie. But again,
that's Zemeckis' interpretation, right? Like, again, it's not a definitive text. I know this because it was put in a documentary to say this was done intentionally.
Right.
Ray Winstone said, oh, that kind of looks like me, but when I was a teenager. So, you know. There it goes.
Word, I always thought was weird too. Because what isn't it Shakespeare, the weird sisters? But is it word sisters?
From my understanding, it was word. It's the old English term for fate or destiny. But if that weird is, I like to say word. I've read in my studies that it's word. I have heard in the weird sisters, but in this particular reference to Beowulf, it's not about fate or destiny. It's actually a direct reference to God.
Word and life.
Educate me if I'm incorrect on that.
No, that sounds right.
We should all question our teachers, but I'm going to give it a try.
Yeah. Please
I'm
do.
I'm going to trust you here.
And in truth, I'm so glad that you said that, because that's exactly what in my classrooms would educate, which is like, I'm not always right. And I do not know anything about anything. I just know about what I read. I know about what I've been taught. And so if you catch me saying something that you know I am not correct in, please, please. And it's funny because then they'll be like, what? Wait. And so I'm all for it. And I'd love to really dive into that, because to my understanding, it was word. It could be weird. Either way, that's the play on words to that I enjoy.
Yeah. Word Al Yankovic.
Exactly.
I love it. Renzo, I interrupted you on a overlay. What were you about to mention?
I forgot about it, and I'm going to passive aggressively hold it against you for the rest of our lives. So don't worry about it.
Well, I want to talk a little real quick. Your coach, Espinosa, other things that you've coached, and could you speak a little on, we see these warriors in this film, but the role of kind of physical fitness in both teaching and writing, do you think it plays a part in creative play?
I don't think I know, absolutely. My role in physical fitness, I write because I need to maintain not just my physical capabilities, but I write for mental health. And I think that if I did not have my words and my pen, and when I get into a classroom, I say, all right, take out your swords. And everybody pulls out their pen. And that's how my physical being and my fight for the physicality and for being physically fit is very much to be mentally fit. I don't think that for a second I take having a mind, a right mind, pun intended, for granted. And I don't think I would have a right mind if I didn't write or teach writing. So when you say physical fitness and the battle, I think absolutely. I have a battle of words. I have a battle in body, a battle in mind, a battle in soul, a battle in spirit. But every day I pick up my sword. And that sword, I write bearing the only arms I will ever know, which is my word. Yes, absolutely. I think there is a direct connection between within the battle and characters, the text to self, the text to world. That's important in creating a space that breeds health, not just physically, but mentally.
You know, we've spoken about the teacher as Beowulf, but can we talk about Wiglaf and students?
Yes, absolutely.
Because Wiglaf, in both versions, the poem and the movie, he's the audience. He represents loyalty without spectacle. He stays when others run away. In the film, he's kind of the moral counterweight to Beowulf, what Beowulf cannot be, which is tested at the end.
I just always found that he was maybe a bit jealous. Maybe it had a bit of...
But
how do you feel about that?
I don't. No? Here's why. At the very beginning, when Beowulf is confronted by the Malkovich character and saying, yeah, you lost the swimming race to some dude, and like, how are you going to kill Grendel if you can't even win a swimming race? Beowulf goes into it. But even then, it seems like Beowulf won't allow himself to be vulnerable, saying, I was seduced by a mermaid. I made love to a mermaid under the sea. No, I stabbed the beast and killed it. What he did inside the ocean was way more epic than what he was recounting. The truth seemed even more epic than the legend in the movie. He said, I fought like 20 beasts, and Wiglaf was like, last time it was 3, last time it was 7, right? But aside, never contradicting him in front of everybody else. This was to people that were in their inner circle.
Right.
When Beowulf goes to face Grendel's mother the second time after he's in his 70s, when he's been king, he wants to confess. He wants to unburden himself with Wiglaf. Wiglaf says, no, you are Beowulf. You are the slayer. Let's kill this wench and go home. And then at the end, Beowulf does something heroic, does what he needs to do, self-mutilation, self-sacrifice to end his own curse. We can even look at the dragon as innocent in a way in terms of the sins of the father. I'm not excusing the wholesale murder the dragon does, this cycle that he begot. Wiglaf goes up to Beowulf with tears in his eyes and says, like, you did it. And he's like, right now, let's speak the truth. But even then, at that point, Wiglaf needs to believe in Beowulf. So there is a relationship in terms of like they're busting each other's balls. They're, you know, you have a friend, they pick on each other. But when it comes to, you know, when people say like, okay, I can talk shit about my brother, but you better not talk shit about my brother. Exactly. So I think Wiglaf is that both in the poem and the movie, he's the one who witnesses Beowulf, probably sees whatever moral shortcomings he has and still thinks he is the best of men. And I don't know if it's because he needs to believe in something greater or because he has that genuine affection, whatever the reasons are. I don't think he covets what Beowulf had. He would be happy to support him the entire time.
I agree.
But then at the end, when he's faced with the choice, it's ambiguous. Is he going to succumb to the seduction of the Angelina Jolie character? He's stepping in, but he hesitates, and it ends. We don't know.
Exactly. And the ambiguity in the ending is wonderful. And forgive me, I was for a second mistaking Unferth and Wyla.
Okay, okay, yeah. So, super jealous.
Like, super jealous. I love his character being, for lack of a better word, a ride or die for Beowulf, like his kinsman, his right hand, if you will. But I think that in his strength and in saying an agreement, in complete agreement with what you said, being this steward for him, but at the end, even despite his strength, he's susceptible to this femme fatale, right? Yes. And that's what I think the movie wants you to hone in on, which is this inevitable curse of the kings, curse of the fathers. This inevitable, doesn't matter how loyal, how brave, how strong you are, you're susceptible to this kind of...
But I see it differently.
Siren.
I agree with you, but I see it differently. I think everybody's susceptible. You know how bravery is not the absence of fear. The absence of fear is stupidity because you don't know what consequences are. Bravery is facing your fears.
Uh-huh.
I guess it depends on how you read it. The way that I see it is more optimistic. The hesitation that he has at the very end before it goes black. I mean, he's in the water. He's heading towards it and he stops. And then you don't know what's going to happen. Angelina Jolie's character has this very like... Nala eyes, look in her eyes, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, very seductive.
Nala eyes.
Very Nala eyes. And he just stops. Brendan Gleeson, who I adore as an actor, Brendan Gleeson plays Wiglaf. He stops. Oh, we can change our stars. We don't have, like, just because we're men doesn't mean we have to fall into these same traps, but we don't know. That's what I'd like to believe. I want to open this question up to both of you because you're both educators. Wiglaf worshipped Beowulf. I think that some students... worship their teachers. We all have that one teacher we thought was amazing, like that one teacher that meant something to us. I think there's a danger there, right? Like when we idolize someone, and I'm sure you, both you, Scott, and you, Crystal, you guys have, you know, very gregarious personalities, very open personalities. Like you can have people that follow what you're saying. Have you been in situations where that mentor role has been complicated because the truth versus the legend came into conflict?
Renzo, that's a wonderful question. And it's a wonderful question because I, as an adult, think about how I became an educator and I was educating students at 21 years old. I was in a classroom at 21 without the slightest idea about life, really, having had experiences. I was in a classroom teaching AP language and composition, which is the art of argumentation. And how to teach students how to argue effectively. But at that time, I was very politically driven. I was very aware of the world. I was very rage against the machine, if you will. I reflect now in retrospect and think, who let me do that? Who let me teach kids to argue effectively about positions that were my... And I don't necessarily think that I imposed my opinions upon my students, but I think my bias definitely played a part in my education.
Your charisma had an impact.
Yeah, my passion, if you will. It wasn't until about 30, I'm 37 now, it wasn't until about 30 where I realized just how impactful some of the things that I had said to previous students were, because you meet them as adults. You know, you're in the supermarket and he's got his kid in his hand and he's got a full-time job and he's a graduate. And he's like, I remember when you said this, 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 and this, and you're empowered. But then you go home and I've gone home and sat and said, okay, when did I say this, this, and this? And how did I show up? Because I'm very much a self-reflective person and I always want to show up as the best person to educate. And now having more years of experience, I have questioned that. I have questioned, have I been the best leader and the best role model that I could have ever been? And I think the truth of the matter is yes. Because despite maybe being influenced and biased a little bit, I always kept my personal feelings and I always kept the room open for them. And I always, always said, this is not how I want you to think. This is how I think. I want you to think bigger than me. I want you to be better than me. I want you to be a better writer than me. And I think that gives me peace. But in truth, I do that false idol that could I have taught better? Could I have said this better? Has always been something and will always be something that I live in, not just as an educator, but as a person, because even when your best friend comes up to you for breakup advice and you have that conversation and you say, you know what you want to say, but you can't because this is your best friend and you have to let her come to her own conclusions and you have to let her build and breed her own mindset and you can't be the educator in this situation. You just have to be the listener. I think that inside and outside of the classroom, being a false idol or someone who offers advice when they're being asked to listen, I wish I had the tools to say, do you want advice or do you want me to listen? But I learned very, very quickly that I wasn't the only person dispensing knowledge in a classroom when I went through my own trials and my own tribulations. And I realized my kids gave me the life I needed to survive the same way I was giving it to them. Yeah, you know, you question that as an educator all the time, at least for me. But when I sit down beside myself and I ask myself, have I done the very best with what I have? And did I teach with the utmost sincerity and the most passion and the most love that I could? And the answer is yes. Could it be better? Yeah, it could always be better.
What comes to mind for me is I come from a family of both teachers. So my dad was a teacher, actually a coach for 30 years. My mom taught ESL and her students were an extension of our family for a period of time. Like I have these crystal clear memories of going to the movie theater with my mom and her students. We saw this movie called Mi Familia. She taught ESL, or English as a second language, English language learner. And them just learning so much from her, them learning from her. And because of that, there was such a just cultural exchange too, because these students, they didn't speak the same language, but she was tasked with teaching them English. For me, having grown up though with a family of teachers, I had a chip on my shoulder that I didn't want to go that route early on. And realized, though, that my gifts were in performance more than extracting within a classroom. So, like, and there's a crossover, but early on it was like, all right, on a stage, I'm that spark for one 45-minute period, and then the teachers come in and they are able to extract what these guys were saying on stage to that would have ripples. Then after having toured for a while and done that for years, then I wanted to get into the classroom. And what a different beast it really is to be with those students for the course of the entire year, where you're seeing them grow as students, but as people, and your lives are really, you know, intermingling. Not to say that, you know, kids will still come up to me from a performance that I did, but the ones that, you know, it's not an autograph sign or a picture, it's, oh, this was my life, are the ones that I actually taught, that I still, you know, still keep in contact with. I taught at a school with students on the autism spectrum, and we check in just every couple months. They're graduating. Two of them are graduating college right now, and it's a beautiful thing.
I mean, we all have our own wig laughs.
Yeah.
Well, I thought you were going to go in a little slightly different direction with like that moment of temptation that Wiglaf had at the end. And I'm curious to hear from y'all how you do withstand that temptation in life. Whatever comes to mind with me is like, all right, if there's an ex-partner of mine, you have to set that boundary of like someone that you've been with in the past to not put yourself in a situation where the boundary could be crossed. You know, you got Angelina Jolie in this picture, say what you will. His moral character would be able to, okay, keep it moving. But there's something to be said for when someone you've been intimate with in the past or whatever, that lineage, and just being in that room with them, how difficult it is to resist that temptation. So I'm curious, yeah, what are some other temptations in your life or temptations that you've faced with and how you keep it moving in those precarious situations?
That's a beautiful question. And I think that not just in temptation sexually and with a previous partner, I think that this pertains to temptations in general or just respect in general and how I'm going to answer this. But for the sake of you and the sake of the film and that seductory and the seducing, the femme fatale, my aunt had said to me once in midst of breakup, if you had a daughter, would what you're doing and how you're being make her proud? Would you want her to make the decisions that you are making? And in that very moment, that seduction, that temptation, those inner demons, those, well, what ifs, all fall to the wayside because at that moment, it's not about me. And it's not about that instant gratification. This is about education. And this is about life beyond me. And so I think that that's how I answer most of my what ifs these days, which is, I know this might not be a good idea. Or maybe this could be fun, but I'm not really sure if this is fun. But also just in being a partner, in being someone who values respect, and being someone who values honesty and commitment, reminding myself of that and teaching my students that too. Like when you, for example, I just had a student the other day who I had to suspend for, we won't get into it, but I had to say like, this is a suspension, not because I don't want you to be a student, but because I need you to understand if you had a son or a daughter in this building, would you allow you in here? And his whole world shot up. His eyes shot open. And he said, no, you have to do what you, this is absolutely what you need to do. He was in agreement. He was almost signing his suspension papers for me. So it's in the moment when you realize that life is not about you. So what? She's in the water and she's seducing you with these eyes and this, that. But like, think about the collateral damage. Think about who you made a commitment to and think about what you swore to uphold as a man. As a woman, even as a student, right? Like, this is my commitment. My commitment is to come here and show up XYZ. My commitment as a partner is to come up and show up XYZ. And then to sit back and say, how can I behave in a way that I wouldn't educate my child to? Then that's something you got to sit with in self.
Cheers.
Cheers.
I have always been someone who has had no issue with delayed gratification. I'm somebody who saves. I'm somebody who works out. I'm somebody who counts calories. I've never had an issue, but I know that the United States as a whole has an issue with instant gratification. To me, how do I resist temptation? Maybe I can tell you an anecdote. I had a girlfriend in college, and one day she came up to me in front of my friends too, and she said, you know, I know you'd never cheat on me. And I'm like, oh, because I love you. She's like, no, you love yourself too much to be in the wrong. Damn, she was right, by the way. She wasn't wrong. But I was like, how dare you? Because the legend was better than the truth, right? Like, I am this romantic bot who would never hurt you. Yeah. No, I loved myself too much. I couldn't stand myself if I thought that I had... I do have a tendency to punish myself. I've moved past that as I've grown older. But that was my tendency growing up. So she wasn't wrong. And that's how I would resist it. I just saw a dragon raise the town. I don't want that. I'm already king. I don't have to sleep with you to be king. So to me, it's a no-brainer, but I do understand that it's like, well, but it's Angelina Jolie, or it's this person, or it's that person. And there's no better sex than the one you're having in your head. Okay? Right. None. So to me, it's pretty easy, but it does beg the question, what does it cost a society to keep believing a story it knows it's false? That to me is so pertinent right now. And that's what the movie explores. Hrothgar, Grendel was Hrothgar's bane. The second Grendel was out of the picture, he's like, oh, awesome. You had sex with her? Here you go. Ah, dead. Right. I'm free. She still claimed his body. No, she kept the body count.
She kept the body.
Right? She still claimed Hrothgar's body. And then Beowulf was very interested in Queen Wealhtheow, played by Robin Wright. Always be the princess bride. She just seems like she evolved in this one. They had a thing. There was love there. But he was seduced in the moment, and it cost him his vulnerability, his relationship with this person that he apparently seemed to have loved. At the end of his life, he confessed, like, I have always loved you.
Right.
But he just couldn't find a way to do it because the narrative was more important. There's this very pivotal scene in the movie where I forgot who the Danes were fighting, because in this version, not in the poem, but in this version, he becomes king of the Danes. And he's like, I am Beowulf. You can't kill me because of that. It's basically like, I am this legend. I am this thing. And I felt that he was raging not at the opponent. He was raging at himself.
Agreed.
He was raging with regret. I think collectively as a society, I would rather believe in Superman than Homelander. But the line can be blurred very clearly. There is a cost to thinking Homelander is Superman, a reference like an evil person is a good person. There is a cost to that. And the house always wins. Accounts will always be squared. The way that I see the whole Wilgoff situation is he already went through all that. That's how he's going to resist temptation. He doesn't need it. Why sacrifice everything? I know we have to wrap up as we're going through it, but there's a couple of things I wanted to make sure we address. I did want to address Beowulf's relationships with women in this movie. I wanted to talk about Queen Wilgaf. I wanted to talk about Grendel's mother, maybe even the mermaid and the tavern wench, or that they made a very specific scene of seeing her cleavage go up and down as she's cleaning, right?
Very seductive.
Crystal, from your perspective, what is this movie trying to say about the dynamics between man and woman, male and female, genders, for lack of a better term, when it comes to telling legends? Because I'll give you my take. The second that Beowulf sleeps with Grendel's mother, his phallus is gone. He's no longer king. He can't attack. He can't conquer. She took that from him. And she wields his son as a phallus at him, right? Like, it's she attacks. She has the power. That's the way that I'm reading it, or the way that I'm reading their performance. So I feel that there's this fear in the sense of women being empowered, that they can't coexist, that it has to be this one or the other. So Grendel's mother has to be a monster in the king's mind. What is this movie trying to say about the dynamics between the genders when it comes to power dynamics?
I think it's difficult to, if we're talking about the movie.
The movie. We'll talk about the movie.
2007, having a little bit of a nuance to the a reference to the film. I think that women are very much underplayed and very much used as these vixens for femme fatales. And I think it stems as early as from the epic poem, because when you consider that poem, Grendel's mom doesn't have a name. And the only female in the movie who has a name is the queen. Don't quote me on that. I think...
Oh, the concubine has a name, but I can't remember. Yeah. But then again... Again, I can't remember it, right?
Right. But so it's they're just these characters that are placed in this film as secondary characters. I think that women were very much overlooked, but I think what the irony is that for a character to have no name, but then end the entire movie as the most powerful character in the movie, having her being the end all be all, and that ambiguity landing on whether or not she's going to curse someone. I think that despite whether or not there was a direct correlation between the power that women have, like specifically stated, I don't think it was specifically stated, but I think for lack of detail, I think that there was power within women that was not directly stated. Whereas in the poem, I don't think that there were women at all. They were not addressed at all. They were not given remotely any strengths whatsoever. But I do. I think that the power dynamic, especially in such an old tale, is very much real. Like, that women didn't have any. And so this siren, this supernatural creature, this being, this powerful, I keep saying femme fatale. It's the only word that's coming to my head.
No, but she was, you're right. She behaves like a femme fatale from a noir, but she was literally a king maker.
Right.
She made Hrothgar king.
She made Hrothgar king.
She made Beowulf
king. And then there she is deciding whether she's going to make Wiglaf king at the very end. And I think the fact that she has no name sheds light on the very reality, which is all of these individuals who died sought power and fame, which is, I'll reference it in my poem. I think that there's a lot to be said if you fight for power and a title. But there's more to be said if you fight for purpose. Despite the fact that we don't know the siren's story and why she cursed or why she chose to do what she does, I think at the end of the day, it's a grieving mother. And I think at the end of the day, she's very much out and en route to hurt the very individuals who have hurt her, and does so without claim to any throne, and does so without any ill will, so to speak. Like, there's no personal gain. There's no money and power and riches and the golden horn and all these things. I just don't see that in the siren, despite the stories that you hear about sirens, right? That's a tough one. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I'm centered in on the queen a little bit. Queen
Wealthow.
Her Wealthow as queen, as muse, I guess, and the power of, I mean, she's the only one that plays the lyre, right? She's supposed to be peacemaker within that.
But she also knows in the movie. There's this inclination that she like kind of knows what's going on, yeah. Right? When they're older, it's kind of like this like side eye, and it's like there's that other unspoken power that they're giving a woman. So that's why I'm having a hard time describing the power dynamic, because I feel like if you see the film, you know that these women are powerful, but they're not addressed as powerful. They're not even given names. But then there are these moments, these like asides, these small captures and things that you're like, wait a minute. You know, and it very much breeds power. But in the epic poem, it's not that. So that's why I'm having a hard time.
And that complicates it for me, too, because right? She knows. But she also, like Wiglaf, like everybody else, is keeping the story alive. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm saying, what is the cost for a society to keep that story that it knows it's false? She knows in her bones. The reason she didn't touch Hrothgar anymore, other than him being older or like a drunk. After you told me that you slept with the demon, how can I be with you? And he's like, I never should have told you. She's no longer sleeping with Beowulf. It's implied because Ursula was the name of the concubine. Because yes. He has the young Ursula. Because she knows that he was with her. And when he was able to admit it is when they were able to say, we love each other. Again, I think it's a lot of symbolism there.
Isn't that beautiful, though? In his admitting and in his honesty to her about his relation with the concubine. And about his relation with the siren, she was able to come forth and say, well, thank you, right? Like, I love you. And then that was brought together. And I think that that is what lacks in the male character throughout, which is that inability to be honest, to be so strong and to be willing to fight monsters and cross seas and do all these incredible things, but the inability to be honest about your sexual relations and vulnerability. Being vulnerable is baffling to me, because that's why all this terror and all this horror has been rained upon this town. The lack of honesty and sincerity.
It's really saying, I'm not perfect. Right. That's all he has to say. That breaks the curse, right? Which is, again, with Wiglaf, what makes me hopeful. Do you have any reflections on teaching texts that resist closure the way that Beowulf does?
Teaching texts that end ambiguously is important for an individual to make their own sound decisions. Oftentimes relationships end without closure. Does that mean you don't know who you are in character? Oftentimes you lose people before their time. Does that mean you didn't know who that person was? So in reading a book that is open for interpretation in the ending, does that mean you no longer like it because you're unsure of how it ends? That if that were the case, if you were uncertain if you liked a book because it didn't have closure, then you wouldn't like life, because no one knows how life ends.
I remember reading Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which is Blade Runner. And that, is he a replicant? Is he not? And it really is up to you. It really is up to you. But I think that helps develop critical thinking. It helps develop the ability to accept other realities than your own, which I think helps breed empathy.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree. And I just keep thinking about how that compares to film, where I guess when I was growing up, a film that had that open-ended wasn't as satisfying for me. You know, you debate it with your friends, but you kind of wanted to know, all right, what was the director's vision that he had, you know, on this film? But now from a book standpoint, after you've been with the characters for probably a greater amount of time you want to have that discussion to unwind it and break it down. Film-wise, I've said this before, like if there's a trauma that occurs on a film and it breaks you apart, I want the film to put me a little bit back together before it ends. I don't like to leave the theater completely in shambles. A book, maybe I can exist in my imagination a little bit longer after it's ended.
How'd you feel about Coco? Or any Pixar movie? Up. Oh. Just the first 15 minutes of Up.
But they put you back together.
All right, and then just one final question, because we touched upon it before, but I really like to expand more on Papa poetry. poetry in a public space versus poetry as a monument, poetry on the written page versus performing poetry. Could you tell us more about Papa Poetry, why it started, what you're doing for the community? Because that's actually one of the reasons I admire you greatly.
That just touched my heart. And yes, always so willing to talk about Papa Poetry, MIA. As a lifetime poet, I came down to Miami and I was searching for a creative space. I will never speak about Papa Poetry without shouting out Miami Poetry Club. I stumbled into a writing workshop, stumbled into Poems and Poetry for Miami Poetry Club and thought, this is the epitome of community and the epitome of what I've been looking for and love it. I was wanting to create a space of poetry on my own. And in seeing what they do, I thought, I want to do this, but I don't want to just bring it to one space. And just being an advocate for community, I thought to myself, well, how can I bring poetry to communities? And I thought, well, where do communities need help? We live in a world, I was dating someone who worked in the industry, and I know how hard industry individuals work. And I thought about businesses opening and closing in Miami, and I thought about the same struggles that us as artists have. Constantly searching for new places to find work, constantly searching for creative outlets. And I thought, well, if I can take these industry places, these venues, and reach out to them and see where their weakest moments are, I can guarantee you poets and bring you poets and have this space where we can just sit and drink and talk and let loose and have a great time, get people out of their heads, out of their beds, and into a space where they feel safe. Papa Poetry came to be because I myself needed a space to practice. I needed a space to exist. And I know that very much in a world where we're, as poets, we're so in tune with writing alone and living alone and being in our creative outlets. Papa Poetry became a passion project that now has become a lifelong and hopefully a lifelong place. I was sitting at Magic 13. And I had this idea in my head for a really long time, and I just didn't want to do it alone. So I met Kenny at Miami Poetry Club, KC Penn, and I was sitting next to him at Magic 13, and I looked at him and I was like, hey, dude, I've got this idea. And I want to take poets to local spots every other month, spots that are new to Miami and old to Miami, and bring poetry to community. And I want to do it in a less slam in a less competitive fashion, but a more, let's just drink and have a good time with poets. You want to help me? And he was like, absolutely. That's how it came to be. It was very much an organic decision to use what I love and give back to local community vendors and local community poets. The extension of that is I stepped out of the classroom and now I'm an administrator and I'm no longer teaching writing in the classroom. Part of my teaching now exists in Papa Poetry, which is local poets come out to the open mic and local poets come up to me and ask me for feedback. And they're striving to be a feature and they're working on their poetry. And some poets come up to the stage and they say, I've never spoken a poem out loud, but Papa Poetry gave me the space to do it. And that's my connection to society and to community and to education that I now have as an administrator. Papa Poetry MIA is not mine. It's ours. And that's why it's successful. It's not about what I decided. It's about what already exists. I just kind of curate the space for everybody to bring what already lives inside of them. And I'm just super, super grateful to have so many people love it and enjoy it. We have our next event February 21st, again at the Camp Gallery. We are going to pick pieces on an artist called Pablo Power. He's a local Miami graffiti artist. The goal is eventually to put our poems in video next to artist pieces in art gallery to show that art doesn't only exist in artwork and in solid form, but in movement, which is my other hat nod to paragraphs and pirouettes and to the way that I love to dance in poetry. And I hope that you guys are there. Renzo, I know that you'll be there. Scott, obviously, you are always welcome. I just want to say this outside of Papa Poetry, please come. I stumbled upon a book at this bookstore in the design district called Dale Zin or Zine. I don't know Dale if Zin. I'm pronouncing. Yeah. And it's called VHS Poems. And so I figured this is the perfect place to shout out the author, Mitsu Okubo. and their poems. And I know that you guys listening can't hear, see rather, but you could hear it. They are VHS tapes lined up in the form of poems. Like, can you guys see this on my camera?
Not with the blur, but it's okay.
It's a blur. So they're VHS tape. I got it for you guys as a gift. And thank you for inviting me.
That's so sweet.
They're VHS tapes and they're stacked up. And I'll just read one or two for you. For example, greedy, simple men, pay it forward, but not for me. So they're the tapes stacked up once on each other. And I thought this was a nice head nod to you guys. And wow. I'm excited to give it to you at our next event. So
Chris, that's lovely.
Yeah, VHS awesome. Poems. Super excited. But yeah, Papa Poetry, come hang out. Come kick it. Shout out to Miami Poetry Club and shout out to Real Poets. Always. All of the ways.
And I gotta...
I love Papa Poetry. And I love just that Renzo's favorite word is ekphrastic. The ekphrastic nature of...
You know this.
Of the alternative venues. I have a quick question. Is there a venue like type that you haven't been to that really intrigues you of combining poetry? Like just off the top, you know, like... Poetry in a bank, you know, or poetry, you know, at a yoga studio, that's happened, or poetry. But for you, is there a place
a movie
that you haven't theater. Seen it that you
a
would
movie
like?
Theater?
Yeah,
a movie theater for sure. I grew up every weekend, divorced family. My dad picked me up every weekend and took me to the movies. And my movies, the movies that I went to see, which is why this podcast means so much to me. The movies that I saw and watching movies as a kid really taught me emotions. You know, you watch your first death, you watch your first love, you watch your first heartache, you watch all that. And that taught me emotions at a deeper level. And I think that one of my favorite places to be outside of in my notebook and in my head is at the movies. And so I'd love to see it at a movie theater. And that's not just because I'm on the podcast, but I would love, love, love to also hit the beach. I think that is a nice space where I would like to hit a sunset beach pop-up poetry event and just have it be a potluck where everybody can come hang out, enjoy the sun, get their feet in the ground and be grounded. But for sure, those two spaces.
Potluck poetry. I dig it. Why did they have to have Mufasa's dead body on screen for so long?
Such a long
with
time.
The Lion King. Probably all poetry is ekphrastic in a way because I've said this before. I think we're made up of all the little pieces of everybody we've ever loved that's ever loved us. Everything they taught us, the your favorite album, your favorite movie, your favorite book. Somebody was involved in showing that to you. And that inspires art. I do want to take a moment and say I'm very excited to be part of the next pop-up poetry. I told you, I think, in person at the last event, you know, I had an idea of doing a collaboration where we have poets reading poems they composed based on works of art at art galleries, because that is just, you're co-creating within the space. Right. You are showing how there's a conversation, the art piece, thesis, your poem, antithesis, the meaning that people get from it, new synthesis, right? This new idea. So I'm very excited because that is, would it be avant-garde? I guess it would be right now these days. It's pushing boundaries and you're doing important work. So I do want to give you a shout out for that. I do want to give Dalezine a shout out because that was the first store where my book was placed. Before it was on Barnes & Noble, before it was on Amazon, before it did anything, it sold out 10 copies of Dalezine. So I always have a lot of love for those guys.
Me too. Love that bookstore. If you haven't checked it out, you need to check it out. It's a wonderful bookstore.
They're in the design district that I guess it's no longer their new location. I remember their older location. This one has air conditioning. This one, all the books have space. It's pet friendly still, I believe. They have a beautiful dog. That brings us to ekphrastic poetry. Mm-hmm. And I would... love to ask Crystal if you would bless us, bless the mic, the Real Poets mic, with your poem based on Beowulf.
I cried so hard once, I pulled a rib from my teeth. It must have been the one torn from Cain, excavated from the same cave Grendel was slain. I too have lain next to the body of my own dragon son, always uncertain of what I or he was destined to become. War weary and mead wrecked, a forever dance with siren devils on ship decks, I cannot begin to explain. How many cursed fathers are to blame for endless terror reigned in the name of honor and fame? The not so epic heroes, fallen from grace because their hubris was anything but humorous. Nothing funny about being 12 years a slave, forced to endure our troubles today, burying our birthrights in early graves. This is the reason we must be mindful of who we ask to be saved. Beowulf.
That was dope. Thank you for that.
My pleasure.
I think for this episode, we shouldn't say the name of the film until the end in the spirit of Crystal.
I love that, actually.
Yeah. Thank you for being here for our episode for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze. Scotty, do you have a poem you'd like to share tonight?
All right, so I started something. Beowulf is composed of these things called kennings, if you're familiar with as a teacher. Kennings, which are these compound metaphoric phrases where they take a word and then they put a metaphor. All I did is come up with a few Ken Kennings. Danger fawn for the Jeopardy goat, Ken Jennings. Outfield of dreamer, Ken Landreau, who played for the Dodgers. Roastmaster General, not Jeff Ross, but Kenny Rogers. If you're feeling bored, what's Missouri's largest mixed with what's mightier than a sword? This is the end. That's K.C. Penn. Kenny Rhymes.
And we get a big shout out for K.C. Penn.
Jeez. Absolutely.
Friend of the
Ken.
Pod.
He's a Ken. He was a Kenning. So I had to.
He's a Ken Ken.
So the next thing I'm just going to read, it's a short thing. I had this idea. I will admit, in the spirit of mixing how this was kind of like done in CGI, what I did was I did go to the ChatGPT, okay?
Thank you for admitting your honesty, something Beowulf could never do.
And
truth greater than legend.
And all I did was I said, write a poem about a childhood star in Old English.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Listen, we have heard in former days a bright-faced hero, first as a boy in Bugsy's band, a sharp-suited spark in a world of guns and song, where youth learned rhythm before the roar of fame. Then in the warm-lit halls of happy days, Chachi called cheers from corner booths, leather and laughter, jukebox bright. Love followed there, Joni beside him, sweetheart sung to the sound of time when youth ruled nights and the world felt kind. Later, he stood as steward of order, Charles in charge, mindful and merry amid household storms. Power flashed once and zapped and jest when thought bent matter and mischief flew, schoolhouse sorcery sparking the screen. His spirit was strength, his craft was presence, word swift as a sparrow's turn. Now we believe that his praise will live long in reruns and rhyme. Scott Beowulf, the shining name held in the heart. Will he be remembered?
Mm.
Okay.
That was about Beowulf. Henry Winkler?
Pretty much. I live with the Bonds, not the Fonz, though.
I know you're always hanging with the Bonds. Shout out to Bonsai. Biggest fan of our first commercial that there ever was.
And he was a stud at Papa Poetry last weekend. He was such a delight to have there. Such a delight.
Thank you. He loves being there. He was wanted to be on stage the whole time, it seems. But he just knows it. Did I do one, two? Did you do one, yes. Two? One, two, one, two? But we're going to post these a little bit later. But me and him do smoothie movie reviews. So once he starts,
he does.
Whatever. It's based on episodes of TV, but we've been doing we did Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and two episodes of Sesame Street coming soon.
Love it.
All right, friends. Well, let's hear it.
I struggled a bit to come up with inspiration for this poem because I was trying to find something maybe I hadn't said. So I thought about doing it from Beowulf's perspective at the end of the film, after the bargains, after the lies, after the legend is no longer useful. It's kind of about what happens when every system meant to carry meaning continues operating after it's lost integrity. And it's also I did do Old English alliterative long line verse. So it is full of kennings.
Okay.
And it has those two stresses and it has the caesuras. So bear with me.
Against all apostles, oath keepers ogle, ornamented ogres, hell walkers handled, hungry and humbled, word weavers wasted, worn and wounded, lie lords' lances, leave love lying, bone house bloodied, banished by bastards, heart locks hardened, homilies hastened, men are mastered by meat pourers mating, coxswains castrated, cowardly carpenters, fathers falter, faithless failures, mothers murdered, manhandled matriarchs, dangerous misdeeds, dangled destruction, wasted mid-wonders, worried and withered, God lay gutted, carotid in the gray, rotting flesh rancid, revenge bitter restraint, our worst objectors, oneself observed against all apostles.
Yes. Got some Blackalicious vibes with the alphabetic aerobics. Yeah.
Crystal,
yes.
Please let us know where we can find you on the Soch, and if you can just remind us of anything you want to promote. I know that you talked about it, but give us the summary again. Just where can we find you on the Soch?
Absolutely. You can find me at Pop-Up Poetry MIA. That is our community pop-up poetry bi-monthly event. And you can find me on my personal at dancin_queens26, dancin_queens26. And you can find my book, Paragraphs and Pirouettes, on Amazon. Book 2 is coming out soon. But you can find me anywhere and everywhere poetry is.
It has been a delight having you here. I hope this is the first of many conversations, whether recorded or not. This was so much fun. And thank you for Beowulf, the great addition to the Real Poets Pantheon.
Well, I want to conclude a little too. I want
to
give
you.
Her some more flowers.
Let's go.
First.
Let's give her flowers.
I just want to say that, yeah, it's such a pleasure to talk with you here. As I imagine you did in the classroom, you command the stage where you really just seem connected to your words all the time. A tenant of pop-up poetry to have your poems memorized, but I always feel, yeah, it's coming from you, an extension of you. And if anybody out there, you get a chance to read her, but also see her perform. Thank you for joining us. And this has been another episode of Real Poets. I'm not Renzo Del Castillo, and he's not
Scott. 3T's Raven, but we both always keep it real.
Real Poets is produced and hosted by Renzo del Castillo and Scott Raven. Original music composed by Gabby Weitzenfeld. Episode art and visuals by the Real Poets team. New episodes come out every other Thursday. Hit subscribe, download the episode, and leave a review to help us grow. This has been a Real Poets production. And remember, to always keep it real.